dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This weekend, Americans in more than 700 cities and towns, as well as people around the world, protested the ongoing war and occupation in Iraq. Grief at loved ones lost, rage at dreams destroyed, and for many, a sense of futility and desperation as the Bush-Cheney administration and their congressional allies make war on all fronts to destroy anything that was good about the United States, transforming it into a brave new Mordor. This week on the program, you may hear something astonishing. Not one, but two activist scholars of worldwide renown, one from Asia and one from Europe, are predicting the demise of the American Empire, a collapse by what they both call its contradictions. And not in some distant future, but soon. The cracks are opening and spreading in its foundation. And from within inner circles comes more confirmation of the real objectives of the Iraq War, a long-held plan of conquest that needed only September 11th, 2001, to proceed. This report was filed on March 17th by Greg Pallast, reporting for BBC Newsnight. It's called Secret U.S. Plans for Iraq's Oil. Pallast reported, "The Bush administration made plans for war and for Iraq's oil before the 9/11 attacks, sparking a policy battle between neocons and big oil," BBC's Newsnight has revealed. 2 years ago today, when President George Bush announced U.S., British, and Allied forces would begin to bomb Baghdad, protesters claimed the U.S. had a secret plan for Iraq's oil once Saddam had been conquered. In fact, there were two conflicting plans, setting off a hidden policy war between neoconservatives at the Pentagon on one side versus a combination of big oil executives and U.S. State Department, quote, pragmatists. Big oil appears to have won. The latest plan obtained by Newsnight from the State Department was, we learned, drafted with the help of American oil industry consultants. Insiders told Newsnight that planning began, quote, within weeks of Bush's first taking office in 2001, long before the September 11th attacks on the U.S. An Iraqi-born oil industry consultant, Falah al-Jibri, says he took part in the secret meetings in California, Washington, and the Middle East. He described a State Department plan for a forced coup d'etat. Mr. al-Jibri himself told Newsnight that he interviewed potential successors to Saddam Hussein on behalf of the Bush administration. The industry-favored plan was pushed aside by yet another secret plan, drafted just before the invasion in 2003, which called for the sell-off of all of Iraq's oil fields. The new plan was crafted by neoconservatives who were intent on using Iraq's oil to destroy the OPEC cartel through massive increases in production above OPEC quotas. The sell-off was given the green light in a secret meeting in London headed by Ahmed Chalabi shortly after the U.S. entered Baghdad, according to Robert Ebel. Mr. Ebel, a former energy and CIA analyst, now a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, flew to the London meeting at the request of the State Department, he told Newsnight. Mr. Al-Jibri, once Ronald Reagan's back channel to Saddam, claims that plans to sell off Iraq's oil, pushed by the U.S.-installed Governing Council in 2003, helped instigate the insurgency and attacks on U.S. and British occupying forces. Insurgents use this, saying, look, you're losing your country, you're losing your resources to a bunch of wealthy billionaires who want to take you over and make your life miserable, said Mr. Al-Jibri from his home near San Francisco. We saw an increase in the bombing of oil facilities, pipelines, built on the premise that privatization is coming. Philip Carroll, the former CEO of Shell Oil USA, who took control of Iraq's oil production for the U.S. government a month after the invasion, stalled the sell-off scheme. Mr. Carroll told us he made it clear to Paul Bremer, the U.S. occupation chief who arrived in Iraq in May of 2003, that, quote, there was to be no privatization of Iraqi oil resources or facilities while I was involved, close quote. The chosen successor to Mr. Carroll, a Conoco oil executive, ordered up a new plan for a state oil company preferred by the industry. Ari Cohen of the neoconservative Heritage Foundation told Newsnight that an opportunity had been missed to privatize Iraq's oil fields. He advocated the plan as a means to help the U.S. defeat OPEC and said America should have gone ahead with what he called a no-brainer decision. Mr. Carroll hit back, telling Newsnight, quote, I would agree with that statement. To privatize would be a no-brainer. It would only be thought about by someone with no brain. New plans, obtained from the State Department by Newsnight and Harper's Magazine under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act, called for the creation of a state-owned oil company favored by the U.S. industry. The plan was completed in January 2004, Harper's discovered, under the guidance of Amy Jaffe of the James Baker Institute in Texas. Former U.S. Secretary of State Baker is now an attorney. His law firm Baker Botts is representing ExxonMobil and the Saudi Arabian government. Questioned by Newsnight, Ms. Jaffe said the oil industry prefers state control of Iraq's oil over a sell-off because it fears a repeat of Russia's energy privatization. In the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, U.S. oil companies were barred from bidding for the reserves. Jaffe said, there is no question that an American oil company would not be enthusiastic about a plan that would privatize all the assets with Iraq companies, and they, U.S. companies, might be left out of the transaction. In addition, Ms. Jaffe says U.S. oil companies are not warm to any plan that would undermine OPEC. They, the oil companies, have to worry about the price of oil. I'm not sure that if I'm chair of an American oil company, and you put me on a lie detector test, I would say high oil prices are bad for me or my company, she said. The former Shell Oil boss agrees. In Houston, he told Newsnight, many neoconservatives are people who have certain ideological beliefs about markets, about democracy, about this and that and the other. International oil companies, without exception, are very pragmatic commercial organizations. They don't have a theology. That a report by Greg Pallast for BBC Newsnight from March 17, 2005, Secret U.S. Plans for Iraq's Oil.
Here is Mordecai Breenberg.
The bookstores have numerous titles with the theme of the making of the American Empire. Walden Bellows' latest book has the reverse theme. It is titled Dilemmas of Domination and subtitled The Unmaking of the American Empire. Walden Bellows has been one of the leading intellectual activists in the anti-globalization battles for more than a decade, prominent figure in mobilizations against APEC, the WTO, and IMF, at World Social Forums, and at international gatherings of the anti-war movement. We reached Walden Bellows at his home in the Philippines. Thank you very much, Walden, for being available at this late hour. You just returned to the Philippines from a speaking tour of Italy, and that tour coincided with George Bush's trip to woo back Europe. How does Bush's European trip reflect the unmaking of the American empire?
Well, I think despite the hoopla and, you know, the sort of triumphalism that accompanied the tour, actually it was a tour undertaken out of desperation because they're caught in a quagmire in Iraq. The number of countries in the so-called coalition of the willing has been steadily been whittling down. And while the European countries have talked about giving support to training police and that sort of thing, all that is very minimal. So the U.S. really main objective was try to get the Europe on board on its bandwagon in Iraq, and it didn't succeed in that. So I think that the hope was that they could, in fact, get the Europeans to give them the legitimacy that they needed in Iraq, but they have not been able to do that.
Your book, Dilemmas of Domination, that's just come out, analyzes three crises facing the U.S. empire. One's, as you identified, an economic crisis of overproduction, a political crisis of overextension, and a crisis of legitimacy. Could you sketch just briefly for us how you see that economic crisis first?
It's variously called overproduction, overaccumulation, overcapacity. But basically, I think it's been a constant problem over the last two decades, a crisis of profitability that has, among other things, resulted in tremendous installed capacity in both the U.S. and in the global capitalist structure as a whole. It is what is called a contradiction between tremendous productive capacity and limited purchasing capacity globally, which is a major problem, especially when you have so much new productive capacity coming on stream, particularly in China and in East Asia. So I think what we face is really a global capitalist system centered by the U.S. that is prone to stagnation and thereby prone to crisis, which we've seen over the last 10 years, you know, especially the downturns as well as the collapse of the stock market and the increasing reliance on financial speculation and recurrent financial crisis. So I would say that these are all manifestations of a crisis of overproduction, if you can call it that, right?
You also talk about a political crisis of overextension, and I'm curious as to why and how the U.S. has become overextended.
Well, I think that this has always been a matter of big debate within the political and military elites in the United States. You know, despite the fact that the U.S. has tremendous military power, nevertheless, I think that what really counts there is the ability to deploy ground troops. And what the U.S. has found has been an increasing difficulties in terms of being able to put and keep people on the ground. And as we've seen, for instance, in Iraq, they've got about 135,000 troops, whereas just to be able to fight the guerrillas to a standstill, you need about 200,000 to about a million troops. So basically, the capacity for the U.S. to intervene in other areas than in Iraq at this point is quite limited. Certainly, it can threaten, as it has, but I think even the Bush people at this point, and this is the reason for the big trip to Europe, realize that they can't hack it by themselves. They need allies, and those allies are now far and few and far between. But it's always been, ever since the Reagan period, a major dilemma that's been haunting U.S. policy, and especially since now they've realized that the ability to gather and put substantial troops in the ground, they're very limited when it comes to that capacity. As we all know at this point, about 40% of the troops in Baghdad in Iraq are National Guard units that are really what you would call part-time soldiers in the United States. So they're at this point really scraping the barrel, as you call it. And if other crises for them emerge, I don't think they'll be able to respond in the same way that they sent and deployed troops in Iraq. So I guess the image that I use there is that, yes, the U.S. with its conventional and nuclear firepower has a sledgehammer, but having a sledgehammer doesn't kill a fly. It can't kill a fly. And that's what the sort of military structure that the U.S. has at this point in the face of what will increase, what will be more and more insurgencies against the empire in the Third World.
What you list as a and discuss as a third crisis facing the U.S. empire is the crisis of legitimacy. What does that mean, and how important is it?
You know, political systems and empires never, you know, have stood on force alone. In fact, much more important has been the perception of legitimacy that these structures of domination are seen by those, you know, that it rules as enjoying legitimacy. And that's gone for the United States in much of the developing world, in the South. You know, the different crises that and interventions that the United States has pushed, the support for repressive regimes a couple of years ago, and the militarist project of the Bush administration that has really made it very difficult even for allies of the United States within the elites of this country. For instance, take Latin America. Jorge Castañeda, the former foreign minister of Mexico, said that the Iraq war plus neoliberalism has made Latin America so anti-American at this point that people like him, who are allies of the United States, now have to tailor their rhetoric to become anti-American. And the other thing that I think we really need to also stress here is the U.S. has always had this problem that because of its own rhetoric as a democracy, had to go through the process of trying to forge democracies in its image in developing countries. It couldn't rule like an old-style European colonial power. And yet, it has also subverted the formal democracies that it has set up. And so there's hypocrisy there. Plus also in the, especially in the last two decades, the United States is no longer sort of a model for democracy and for civil liberties. I think with the Bush administration and the Patriot Act and the, you know, the complexities of the American electoral process that in 2000 made a minority candidate, a minority, one who gathered the votes of the minority, the president of the United States, that has eroded the perception that the U.S. is any sort of model country.
Now, the United States faces capitalist competitors in Europe, in Japan. We have China as a rising challenge to U.S. domination of the world. Do you think that the elites in these countries, in Europe, in China, and Japan, are developing their own strategies based on an analysis similar to your own, that the United States is as an empire in decline?
Yes, I think there is a sense that the U.S. is overextended. If there's anybody that's benefited from the last few years of the Bush presidency, it's been China, because it's avoided any sort of entanglements abroad, focused on economic growth, and is set to overtake the United States, I believe, as the biggest economy by the first half of the 21st century. I mean, by 2050, yes. And in Europe, I think there is also the sense that the U.S. has, that U.S. aggressiveness has become a threat to European security. And that perception is beginning to hold more and more. And so I think you have a situation whereby, although the United States remains the supreme power at this point, nevertheless, the Atlantic Alliance is dead, and Bush has helped to kill a relationship that was already troubled before Bush, and of course the rise of China in East Asia is going to mean a major geopolitical shift in that area, and in places like Latin America and other places you have increasing anti-neoliberal governments and anti-Americanism and progressive people like Chavez coming to power. You know, you have a shift happening. It's not going to be a drastic sort of cataclysmic shift, but nevertheless, I think it's fairly clear that this shift is happening and the trend is away from the United States rather than on its way, on its side.
As a last question, I'd like to look at this situation of the unmaking of the American empire from the point of view of anti-war organizing. How do you think this unmaking of the U.S. empire helps us to identify vulnerable points against which we can target our campaigns?
First of all, I think that we should realize that what we're up against, while very powerful, nevertheless has feet of clay, one. Two is that it would be very important to do work even, you know, with the forces in Iraq at this point. And some American groups are doing that, in which GIs and their families are beginning to speak out. And I believe that there have been more and more instances of deserters coming to Canada. So I think the low morale of the U.S. Army in particular in Iraq is really a point of vulnerability. As we remember, if you remember, the U.S. Army fell apart internally at the end of the Vietnam War precisely because of tremendous demoralization of troops being part of an unpopular war. So I think the U.S. Military itself has points of vulnerability. And of course, I think the government in Europe must be seen as, at least in some areas, as forces that can be isolated from the United States, and mainly through our working with the anti-war movements in these countries, we can, in fact, appeal to the own security interests of many of these governments to move away from the United States. And then, of course, there is the Arab world, and I think that there's tremendous potential for linkages between the anti-war movement globally and the civil society in the Arab world. And we've been working on that, trying to get that together through meetings and conferences. And, of course, the U.S., of course, tries to make that very difficult by, you know, labeling Arab civil society groups as terrorists or whatever. And so, you know, the forces of opposition are there and growing, and the challenge is how do we articulate all these different forces and coordinate and step up our work across borders. So that's the big challenge at this point.
Walden Bellow, author of Dilemmas of Domination, speaking last week with Mordecai Breenberg of Red Eye Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, B.C. Traveling Soldier is a bi-monthly newsletter of the GI resistance movement to the Iraq War. I'm going to read you a letter from an American soldier serving in Iraq that was published in the current issue of Traveling Soldier. His name was withheld to protect him from retaliation. He writes, "I am a manipulated stooge who sold his soul to exploit the ignorant with the proud lies of our own leaders. I'm told on a regular basis, the army's not like it used to be. Most of the lifers think that the military lacks discipline and blame the new Nintendo generation soldiers for the weakness. However, I think a hard look should be given at the uses of America's advanced military in the modern era. Due to the operations the military has been tasked with in the last 40 years, the nobility of the professional soldier has been destroyed. From Vietnam to Iraq, the armed forces has been a chess piece in a game for money and power by elite Americans. Back in the world wars, the military represented every citizen's will. Today, the people are duped with lies and phony values to support imperial progress. Weapons of mass destruction, links to the Two Towers tragedy, and the ousting of an oppressive dictatorship are all bait for a revenge-hungry, over-patriotic American. I doubt that the men in power are as incompetent as the world imagines. For that reason, I dismiss the apparent failures in Iraq as not the true goals of this war. After these errors are eliminated, you're left with the truth behind the media smokescreens. This war is about money. Most people believe that dollars are being handed over to Iraq to rebuild their country on the backs of the American taxpayers and under the protection of U.S. troops. However, the money never sees Iraq. It leaves your wallet and goes through the system in D.C. and ends up in a corporation with a sizable government contract. Sure, the product is a new road, a schoolhouse, or AK-47s for the Iraqi National Guard. But the money is only making a rich man richer. Even the soldiers are brainwashed into hating the, quote, rag heads. I have overheard soldiers telling racist jokes like, "Why do Iraqis smell so bad? So blind people can hate them too." It becomes easy to hate the Arab people. We don't understand their culture, their religion, and their language. They are a poor people with a lesser quality of lifestyle and standard of living. The average soldier cannot relate to living without electricity, plumbing, and toilet paper. And I'd like to interject here on this. I'm reading a letter from an American GI stationed in Iraq, published in the GI Resistance magazine Traveling Soldier. I'd like to point out that Iraqis had electricity and they had toilet paper. In fact, they had all of the accoutrements of modern industrial civilization until the succession of U.S.-led attacks on that country, starting under the current president's father, continuing through a decade of sanctions, and now this latest attack. Continuing with the letter. The Joes hate Iraqis because the command hypes about being in Iraq to stabilize democracy and fight terrorists on their own ground. The leadership never explains the fact that a majority of Iraqis don't want a republic that is just a branch of the Western materialistic culture, and that they see America as a tyrant equal to the fallen Saddam's Ba'ath Party. Most soldiers mistake the word insurgent to mean a person that is inserted, as if we are fighting men from other countries than Iraq, when insurgent means rebel. The common GI won't investigate why the insurgent will sacrifice himself, because most soldiers would never do the same. But somewhere in the back of the GI's mind, he has a sense that what he is doing here is wrong. It gives him doubt and discourages his morale. The lifers hold on to the lies of the system because the truth would destroy the core of their beliefs. The fact that the stars and bars is only an illusion, for the real power behind the throne could ruin their psyche and crash their egos. They will never let go of their pride and use it as an excuse to cover their fear. A war backed by our nation's cowards. What else would a preemptive strike be good for? Americans get so afraid they will kill in cold blood and thump their chests to claim it for a good cause. History is written by the victors and might makes right. After all is said and done, it will go down that way in the books. We will kill communists, drug dealers, and terrorists. Next will be homosexuals and atheists. Then full circle back to Jews and blacks. Fear and prejudice is destructive, and we dominate using it. Every country folds to American policies, afraid their homes will become the next Baghdad. And our leaders use media to force the United States people into anxiety, using colored threat levels, video of violence, and worst-case scenarios presented as emergency updates. We even had Colin Powell lie to the world's most powerful council, the UN, about Iraq's malicious intent with nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. America intimidates the world while calling the insurgent freedom fighters terrorists. So Americans can't let go of their fear, like it is a security blanket from a childhood memory, just as most people can't relax their guard. In Nam, lifers couldn't relate to the men that were turned on to marijuana. To let your mind and body go and become open to the chaos of the world is impossible for a person who lives in constant fear of the unknown truth. Drug usage isn't as much of a problem here in Iraq amongst the soldiers yet. However, with the draft, the inactive reserve, and more stop loss, it won't be long before more soldiers discover the potency of Arab hashish and opium-based narcotics. There will be a division between the lifers and the heads again. It has already started with the stop-loss soldier obviously not wanting to be in service any longer. Many of them get court-martialed or chaptered out with dishonorables, saving the military from paying an already deserved college GI bill or other veteran benefits. As war here in the Middle East gets more violent, the soldiers will become less afraid of punishment. Prison will become a more sane option than trying to take Fallujah for the fourth time. Most of the soldiers I've talked to have joined for selfish reasons. They wanted money for college, to travel the world, to get out of a dead end, avoid going to prison, or had no direction in life. The boys who joined up to defend the red, white, and blue are few and far between. I met some soldiers that were motivated by September 11th, but not many. It is a need in today's society to find alternative advantages to enlist. And when kids learn what they really signed themselves up for, it's a rude awakening. Many soldiers are counting down to their last day in the military from the first few hours at basic training. For all these reasons, whether the GIs are conscious of it or not, military personnel have a decreased motivation and intensity. We fight for lives, are alienated by our chain of command, and are only trying to ride out the clock until we can finish our contracts without losing what we have worked for or seeing the inside of a prison cell. The armed forces will never have a loyal troop base until its goals change. If there was something worth fighting for, something the common man can gain, rather than just being underpaid mercenaries for some elitist, then the soldiers would have more encouragement to join and work hard. I myself find it difficult to have discipline in an army full of ass-kissing, lying hypocrites who enforce a wicked U.S. policy with a violent war I disagree with. I serve in shame. A Soldier in Iraq. Name Withheld. Published in the current issue of the GI Resistance magazine, Traveling Soldier. You can find Traveling Soldier online at www.traveling-soldier.org. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville in North Carolina.
The following speech, Johann Galtung on the Decline and Fall of the American Empire, was given at UC Santa Barbara on November 22, 2004. Johann Galtung is founder and director of Transcend, a peace and development network for conflict transformation by peaceful means. He's widely regarded as the founder of the academic discipline of peace research, and one of the leading pioneers of peace and conflict transformation in theory and practice. He's played an active role in helping mediate and prevent violence in 45 major conflicts around the world over the past four decades, and in recent years has been involved in efforts to mediate the ongoing armed conflict in Sri Lanka between Tamils and Sinhalese. In this talk, Galtung details 14 political, economic, cultural, and religious contradictions that over the course of the next 10 years will play themselves out in the fall of the American Empire. This program was recorded by Richard Ingram and produced by the LA Sound Posse. It is dedicated to the public domain.
Let me start by defining an empire. It's a transborder, concerted effort to exercise economic, political, cultural dominance, popped up by military efforts. So it is, if you will, four-dimensional: economic, political, cultural, military. In the particular U.S. case, there is a planner in Pentagon who formulated it much more clearly than I can. In a very famous, very quoted statement, the purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safe for American business and for our cultural assault. Full stop. Toward that end, there will be a fair amount of killing. We see that going on right now. I don't think it makes sense to see Fallujah without quoting Directive No. 39 by L.P. Bremer III. That goes to say very clearly the privatization of all businesses owned by the Iraqi state, with the possibility of 100% acquisition by foreigners and 100% repatriation of any profit. The 14 bases being built in Iraq may then serve as an illustration. I think even the Pentagon planner missed out one point. The purpose of the U.S. Army is to make the world safer economic for American business and for political dominance. And in addition to that, for the cultural assault. Now, is it fair amount of killing? The 70 military interventions after 1945 have led to the killing of between 12 and 16 million. That is probably a relatively low estimate. Why is it so imprecise between 12 and 16? Well, it's the difference between overt action and covert action. Let us now say that we have that as a model of what imperialism is about. How would we know that that empire is dead? Well, if we have four dimensions, we have four criteria. And let us say that these are the things that the rest of the world would like to see. Point one, stop killing and withdraw military bases. Point two, stop exploiting. And that means stop extremely unjust, inequitable economic deals. I quoted one example, Directive No. 39 in Iraq, just as one example. But unfortunately, the implications are worse than that, because 125,000 people are dying every day of hunger and easily preventable and curable diseases. If you take that and you multiply it by 360 days, you start coming close to 50 million per year. Now, not all of that is laid at the doorstep of the United States of America. But the interesting thing about the United States of America is that they are the ones who keep the military machinery going that makes it difficult to change it. So when there is an effort to change it, there will very likely be a coup instigated by the U.S. and with a military follow-up. We can now go through the whole post-World War history and document this. And we can ask questions like, why is there an effort to overturn Chavez, but not his predecessor a couple of generations ago, Jimenez? Why the effort to kill Castro, but not Batista? Why is it against the Sandinistas, but not against Somoza? And the answer is very clear. And it lies in the brilliant formulation by the Pentagon planner. So we go on to number three. Join the world. You're not located on a platform named exceptionalism. Join the world, participate in the difficult enterprise of making the world a better place to live for 6.2 billion human beings. The best organization for that today is the UN, with all its shortcomings. You don't step out of the Kyoto Protocol. You invite a conference to revise it if you have grievances, and there are shortcomings in that protocol. You don't step out of the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. You come up with a system that provides the same level of security as that one did. You don't step out of it and introducing the NMD instead. Join the world means that you see yourself as a normal country. And that leads to the cultural aspect of the empire. Give up the idea of being a chosen people by God with a direct mandate, and that you somehow have the solution to all problems. The antidote, the opposite of this, is called dialogue. In other words, to get backwards, dialogue. For the political aspect, participation. For the economic aspect, equity. And then how about the military aspect? Instead of seeing security problems all over, and there are some security problems, but instead of seeing that all over the place, shift your attention. See conflicts all over the place. And instead of building strength, try to solve them. It's possible. It can be done. But in order to do it, you have to give up one idea, namely that the other party is born evil, will continue, remain evil, and that the only remedy is to crush and exterminate. Unfortunately, these four aspects hang together. So I think what the world is demanding is, in one sense, a tall bill. In another sense, not that terribly difficult. Stop killing, withdraw your bases, have equitable economic deals, join the world for all its multilateralism and slowness, and enter into dialogue with a fascinating variety of civilizations. Can be done. Most countries try to do it, more or less perfectly. If this should happen, the greatest beneficiary from the decline and fall of the U.S. empire would be United States of America. It would blossom. Why? Well, first of all, it would get rid of an enormous economic burden. All of us know a little bit about the Clinton deficit and the costs of empire in economic terms. But secondly, it would get rid of an enormous amount of fear. And that fear is based on a mechanism which is ridiculously simple. One day, all these people that we have bossed and bullied and killed will come back and do the same to us. Since there have been 240 military interventions since Thomas Jefferson started in Libya, there are lots of people who might dream of vengeance. In order to get out of that, you withdraw your tentacles and you start processes of reconciliation. Let me give an example. Germany occupied 25 countries during Nazism and tried to exterminate three nations: the Jews, the Sinti Roma, and the Slavs. They had a program for eliminating 100 million Slavs, 50 million by killing and 50 million by starvation. Mainly Russian Slavs, to empty the territory for a German colony. Well, they took 26 million Russians, 6 million Jews, and an unspecified number of Sinti Roma. If you take 25 occupied countries plus three nations, you get 28. Today, Germany has good relations to, practically speaking, all 28. There is one relation which remains problematic. It's with the UK. And why is that? Probably because the UK killed 600,000 women and children, together with the Americans, firebombing German cities. Now, if you have done that, you may get the idea that the Germans are dangerous, because one day they might come back and do the same. And they had some amateurish attempts. A little bit of bombing. It was actually started by the British, 1940. That one also has to be healed. In this case, it is not only Germany who should apologize, but a very proud country located on some foggy islands in the North Sea. According to the internet today, the British Queen has issued a declaration that the independence granted to the United States has been revoked. Now, there are some admonitions coming with that revocation, and the first one is, look up in OED the word revocation so that you understand it. Then you look up the word aluminium, not aluminum, and try to pronounce it. Well, okay. I'll not go further on that line. I'll just say that sometimes you need a little bit soft approach to these serious issues. What I've said so far is that an empire is a very clear construct. There's no mystery what it is about. And it is the synergy between the four dimensions that makes it. The abolition of the empire is not a question of hoisting and unhoisting a flag at midnight. That was the old way of doing it. There are four very clear demands, and they are very reasonable. Point three, the greatest beneficiary will be United States of America. And I stand on exactly the same line as Gore Vidal. I love the U.S. Republic and I hate the U.S. Empire. And please never fall into the temptation of calling somebody who criticizes the U.S. Empire anti-American. It's exactly because we foreigners make that distinction that we're in a position to be honest and say what I exactly said. There are public opinion polls among Muslims showing that more than 80% reject U.S. foreign policy and more than 80% admire United States of America. It's entirely consistent. You can say, don't you get into difficulties when you see the number of people who support Bush? Well, we get into some small difficulties. But you can have difficulties with all countries, you see, including my own, little Norway. But I am perfectly capable of loving my country without admiring Quisling. And I can love Russia without admiring Stalin. In order to make those distinctions, you actually need only two cells in your brain. But if you have only one cell in your brain, it starts getting problematic. So let us now take this construct, the U.S. Empire, and then we introduce an approach to social science called dialectic. Don't confuse it with Marxism. Marxism was a very poor type of dialectic. It's a Chinese concept. Don't confuse it with Greece, with Greeks, with Heraclitus. It is Taoism. It's yin yang. To every force, there is a counterforce. Don't confuse it with Newton. There's no guarantee it will be exactly opposite and that it will be of the same magnitude, but it will be a counterforce. Which incidentally is a reason that the worst game a political elite can play is golf. Because it's a linear agenda. You see those 18 holes? Fill them. Now in the real world, the holes move. They make alliances. They cover up. They shoot the ball back. And worse, suddenly the 18 holes surround the player, starting digging a hole, a quagmire for the player to fall into. Well, that's what the world is like. Now, put the politician into a golf course, and you get an incompetent one as a result. That doesn't mean that he cannot do it in brilliant short time. But he's in for some surprises called dialectic. I have a list here of 14 counterforces to the U.S. Empire. But I'll first make propaganda for my predictive ability. In 1980, I made a prediction with a list of 5 counterforces against the Soviet Empire. That the Berlin Wall will fall within 10 years and the Soviet Empire will follow. One of the places I made that prediction was in Moscow. It was not excessively popular. But one guy came up to me afterwards and said, what makes you think that we will last as much as 10 years? Why? What makes you think that? So I said, well, you know, these 5 contradictions need their time to synergize and synchronize and work themselves through the system. And he said, 5, there are many more, but I don't care to tell you. Well, it fell. It happened. I can mention to you which the 5 were. Number 1, it's very simple. between Soviet Union and the satellites who wanted independence. Number two, between Russia and the other parts of the Soviet Union who wanted autonomy. Number three, between town and countryside in the Soviet construction. Number four, between the socialist bourgeoisie and the socialist working class. And number five, between liquidity and lack of goods. And you can then see all these five working. How about freedom? Well, freedom is in the first two. How about human rights? In the first two, maybe the third two. It's only that, for me to talk about the contradiction, there have to be concrete social forces. Not words, but forces. I can now read for you the 14, but I'd rather take them first in groups. Economic, military, political, and cultural contradictions. You guessed that one, because those are the four dimensions of imperialism. And then there is something I call social contradictions, which are concrete social forces building up. And among them I have between state and capital elites and working classes of unemployed and contract workers, on the one hand. And on the second hand, between the older and middle generation and youth. I have this in two ways, in the global scene and domestically in the US. But let us now simply get started with economic contradictions. I have three, between growth and distribution, between productive and finance economy, and between production, distribution, consumption, and nature. Start with the third one, peak oil. In an economy desperately in need of oil, with very few serious attempts to move in other directions, with a peak oil phenomenon of increasing costs and increasing difficulties finding exploitable places, there will be increasing military warfare to conquer the places. Many of them are in Central Asia. Hence, contradiction number six, which is with the biggest countries in Asia, Russia, China, and India. The oil fields border on them. They are also hungry for oil. It's 40% of humanity. So number three spills into number six. I just give it as an example of the type of synergies you get when you list the contradictions. Climatic changes, global warming. The way in which the U.S. is held accountable exactly by stepping out of the Kyoto Protocol. And you will, of course, remember that people are not necessarily very subtle. When you get into the habit of blaming U.S., U.S. will be blamed for everything. Sometimes even I will come up and say, look, 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 that's going a little bit too far. No, not that one. There are some other crooks in the world. Not all the crooks live in Washington. You have to have a more diverse perspective on the world. At this point, there was a guy called ABB, anybody but Bush. He was also known as John F. Kerry, who had, I think, a very good program in this particular field. Very good and admirable program. I would guess that very many Americans agreed with him on that one. But they didn't have top priority. Other things had top priority. What? Well, I'll give you my best hunch. This is a footnote, an aside. If you believe that you are the chosen people by God, then you would also believe that God protects you. If God protects you, 9/11 would never have happened. It means God did not protect you. Because he would have stopped the planes in the air, like the kamikaze wind that came and stopped the Mongol invasion of Sun Goddess-protected Japan at the end of the 13th century. Anyhow, 9/11 happened. Why? Because Americans hadn't kept their side of the covenant. What was the covenant? 10 Commandments. What do Americans do? Same-sex marriage and abortion. Californication. So given that, what is the way to regain God's protection? Now, what could be more important than God's protection? And then some guy comes and starts talking about windmills. Yeah? Solar collectors. Sounds like petty stuff relative to moral and family values. But I'm then saying that I don't think those moral and family values were just norms to regulate social intercourse. I'm saying that it had a deeper existential fundamentalist rooting, and that is the country in which we are in this moment, right now. Number two was between productive and finance economy. It works the following way. That if you have a very rapid growth in the finance economy, meaning the stocks are doing fine, the dollar is surging, but at the same time you have nothing corresponding in the productive economy, but a sluggish economy with a low growth rate, then the asynchrony between finance economy and productive economy will hit back and take the form of a crash. Last time that happened was 2001, between the so-called new economy and the reality. It's the gap between the finance economy and the productive economy. I predicted it 2 years ahead of time. And I have one advantage in my life. I'm not trained as an economist. So it is so much easier to see reality. When you have to see it through the type of crazy training these guys get, it becomes very difficult. I admire any economist who nevertheless could talk sense. There are not many of them, but it happens. So, having said that sweet, charming little how to make friends remark, then let me just say the following. I think the U.S. is in for a rather major crash in 2005. And I'll give you one hint. Whenever you read that Dow Jones is going up, you are closer to the crisis. Unless there is a corresponding surge in the productive economy, which there will not be. One particular financial instrument has taken the dive already, the dollar. It was 0.8 euro some time again. The euro was $0.8 a short while ago. It's now 130, heading for 140 very quickly. My prediction was, I may be wrong, 140 by the end of the year. And that was done when the dollar was at the 115 range. What does this mean? That there is no confidence in the dollar, given that 60% of the dollar, the U.S. bonds, are owned by a couple of Asian economies, that China and Japan are financing the war in Iraq, that the deficit is, as you know, both the fiscal and the total deficit are enormous and increasing all the time, $2 billion per day. Given that, you have lack of confidence. This lack of confidence will then increase exponentially to a possible free fall. Now, how is the country going to overcome that? There are two possibilities. One is the official one that any economist, any bookkeeper can point out. You use the cheap dollar in order to increase your exports. What's wrong about that one? What's wrong about that one is what I call the social contradictions. And it may not be very well known in the U.S., but the point is simply the following, that there is today an economic boycott of U.S. goods spreading very quickly around the world. It was reported by Lester Brown recently, and Lester Brown, in www.earth-policy.org/update/update44.html, did you get that? Yes? That he reports,